This is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On the show today, Dan tells us about some new music from the Rolling Stones. Then, it's Ask a Teacher. Faith Perlow talks about some strong language. We close with an American story. But first, here's Dan Friedel.
The Rolling Stones said this week that their first new collection of songs in almost 20 years comes out on October 20th. The album will be called Hackney Diamonds. The name comes from broken glass, often seen on the streets of East London's Hackney area. Three of the band's original members, Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, and Ronnie Wood, came to the Hackney Empire, a historic theater, for the announcement. The Rolling Stones are still traveling the world and performing concerts, but they have not made an album since 2016. That recording did not include new material. Richards, 79, said the band only made a new album because Jagger wanted to sing, so they went to record new songs after almost 20 years. "When you have a singer that wants to sing," Richards said, "you grab him and throw him in the studio." Richards said the songs came together with energy and urgency. Jagger, who is 80, said, "We are quite pleased with the new album." He said the group would not have put a recording together if we hadn't really liked it. "We said we had to make a record. We really love ourselves. We hope you all like it." They released the first song, called Angry, this week. But Jagger said the rest of the songs are not angry. He said the album contains love songs, ballads, country sounds. The new recording includes songs with Paul McCartney, Lady Gaga, Stevie Wonder, and Charlie Watts, the Rolling Stones drummer who died in 2021. Watts recorded sounds for two songs in 2019. Steve Jordan is the drummer for the other 10. "Of course, he's missed incredibly," Richards said about Watts, but he added that Jordan was Watts's suggestion for a replacement. Jagger said the addition of Lady Gaga to the album was unplanned. The Stones were recording at a studio in Los Angeles, and Lady Gaga just happened to be in the studio next door. So she recorded the song, Sweet Sound of Heaven, with the band. "She walked in next to me and we started singing together," Jagger said. Wood said McCartney of the Beatles played the bass guitar on one track. "You know, he was loving it." McCartney's band was perhaps the Rolling Stones' biggest rival in the 1960s. Tarek Fioravanti was one of the fans who lined up outside hoping to see the band arrive. He is from Brazil. "I love those guys," he said. "They're 80 years old. Most bands have stopped making music by that age," he added. The Rolling Stones started in 1962. They celebrated their 60th year with a tour of Europe in 2022, and they said they have plans to visit North America in 2024. Wood, 76, plays guitar. He said the idea of retirement is impossible. You've got to keep playing, he added. I'm Dan Friedel.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Hi there. This week on Ask a Teacher, we will answer a question about the difference between mandatory, compulsory, and obligatory. Hello, my name is Nelson, and I'm from Nicaragua. Can you help me to understand the difference between compulsory, mandatory, and obligatory? Thank you in advance, Nelson. This is a great question, Nelson. These three adjectives have the same meaning, so they are synonyms. They share a basic definition of required. But there are some slight differences in how often we use each. Let's start with the most common, mandatory. Mandatory comes from the word mandate, which means to give authority, to act, or as a noun means an official order. Something that is mandatory is the result of that action or order. It usually comes from a law or rule. This is the most common of the three words in question, because it is often used in everyday conversations. We use it to describe something that is required by a mandate, law, or rule. In most public high schools, there is mandatory testing every year. Seatbelts are mandatory in the U.S. If you do not wear a seatbelt, you are breaking the law. Compulsory is the second most common adjective out of the three, so it is used less often than mandatory. It also means required by law. We often use it to describe education and military service. Many countries in the world have compulsory military service, like Ukraine, South Korea, and Egypt. Massachusetts became the first place in the United States to have compulsory schooling for children in the year 1642. The least common adjective is obligatory. But it is the most formal of the three. It means the same as mandatory and compulsory, but also has other meanings. We use obligatory not just for laws or rules, but we use it to describe obligations that are based on moral or social instances. Social media is now the obligatory way to message friends because young people do not like to talk on the phone. Another way we use obligatory is when we are talking about something that people have stereotypically used but is not really needed. Many movies for young people feature obligatory dance scenes at the end of the film. The obligatory 2-week notice before you quit your job is common in the U.S., but not required by law. Please let us know if these explanations and examples have helped you, Nelson. Do you have a question about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Faith Perlow.
You just heard Ask a Teacher. Now the teacher joins me in the studio. Welcome back to the show, Faith.
It's great to be here with you, Katie.
This week, you answered a question about the words mandatory, compulsory, and obligatory. Have you heard this quote? Growing old is mandatory. Growing up is optional. What do you think it means?
I have heard of it. Growing older is a necessary part of life. Everyone grows older, hopefully. We want to have a long and healthy life. In the quote, mandatory means necessary. So everyone will have to grow older.
So what do we mean when we say growing up?
Growing up is a phrasal verb that means to progress from a child to an adult. Growing up has to do with physically becoming an adult, but it also means mentally and emotionally becoming an adult. There are a lot of things children get to do that, when they grow up, they do not get to do as adults, like play with friends outside, or play pretend, or just simply have a lot of fun.
Ah, the quote means that even if you grow older, you can still have fun and be a kid at heart.
That's right, Katie. Growing up is not mandatory.
Thanks again, Faith. See you soon.
Love of Life by Jack London. Part 2.
The man cursed, threw the empty gun on the ground. He uttered a cry of pain as he started to drag himself to his feet. It was a slow task. When he finally stood on his feet, he needed another minute or two to straighten himself so that he could stand as a man should stand. He climbed a small hill and looked about. There were no trees, no bushes. There was nothing but grassy, gray plants and some gray rocks and gray streams. The sky was gray. There was no sun or promise of sun. He had no idea where north was. And he had forgotten how he had come to this spot the night before. But he was not lost. He knew that. Soon he would come to the land of the little sticks. He felt that it lay to the left somewhere, not far. Possibly it was over the next low hill. He returned to prepare his pack for traveling. He assured himself of the existence of his three separate portions of matches, although he did not stop to count them. But he did pause, trying to decide what to do about a bag made from moose skin. It was not large. It could be covered by his two hands. But he knew it weighed 15 pounds, as much as all the rest of the pack. This worried him. He finally set it to one side and proceeded to roll the pack. He paused again to gaze at the moose-skin bag. He picked it up quickly, with a quick glance around him. It was as if he thought the cruel wasteland was trying to steal it. When he rose to his feet, the bag was included in the pack on his back. He started walking to the left, stopping now and again to eat muskeg berries. His ankle had stiffened, but the pain of it was nothing compared with the pain of his stomach. His hunger was so great he could not keep his mind steady on the course he had to follow to arrive at the land of the little sticks. The berries did not help his hunger. Their bitter taste only made his tongue and mouth sore. He came to a valley where some birds rose from the rocky places. "Coo, coo, coo," was the sound of their cry. He threw stones at them, but could not hit them. He placed his pack on the ground and followed them as a cat advances on a bird. The sharp rocks cut through his trousers until his knees left a trail of blood. But the hurt was lost. in the pain of his hunger. He moved his body through the wet plants, becoming wet and cold in the process. But he did not notice this, so great was his desire for food. Always the birds rose before him. Their cry of "Kurr, kurr, kurr," sounded as if they were laughing at him. He cursed them and cried aloud at them with their own cry. Once he came upon one that must have been asleep. He did not see it until it flew up in his face from behind some rocks. He grasped the air as suddenly as the rise of the bird, and there remained in his hand 3 tail feathers. As he watched its flight, he hated it. He felt that it had done him some great wrong. Then he returned to where he had left his pack and lifted it again to his back. As the day continued, he came into valleys where game was more plentiful. 20 or more caribou passed by within easy shooting distance of a gun. He felt a wild desire to run after them, certain that he could catch them. A small black animal came toward him carrying a bird in his mouth. The man shouted. It was a fearful cry, but the animal, leaping away in fright, did not drop the bird. Late in the afternoon, he followed a stream which flowed through some thick grass. He grasped these grasses firmly near the root and pulled up what looked like a vegetable. It was round and white. Eagerly, he sank his teeth into it. It was tender on the outside and gave the promise of food, but its inside was hard and stringy, and like the berries, it had no food value. Nevertheless, he threw off his pack and went among the grasses on his hands and knees, eating the grass like a cow. He was very tired and often wished to rest, to lie down and to sleep. But he was led on not so much by his desire to find the land of the little sticks as by his hunger. He looked into every pool of water, searching without success for things to eat. Then, as the night darkened, he discovered a single small fish in one of these pools. He plunged his whole arm in, but the fish escaped his grasp. He reached for it with both hands and stirred the mud at the bottom of the pool. During his excitement, he fell in, getting wet as high as his shoulders. Then the water was too cloudy with mud to allow him to see the fish. He was forced to wait until the mud had again settled to the bottom. Then he tried again, until the water was again filled with mud. But he could not wait. He took a tin container from his pack and began to empty the water from the pool. He threw it out wildly at first, and so short a distance that it flowed into the pool again. He worked more carefully, trying to be calm, but his heart was pounding and his hands were trembling. At the end of a half an hour, the pool was nearly dry. Not a cupful of water remained. And there was no fish. Then he discovered a narrow opening among the stones through which it had escaped into a larger pool, a pool which he could not empty in a night and a day. If he had known of the opening, he could have closed it with a rock before he began, and the fish would have been his. Thus he thought, and he sank down upon the wet earth. At first he cried softly to himself, and then he cried loudly to the uncaring wasteland around him. He built a fire and warmed himself by drinking hot water. Then he built a camp on the rocks as he had done the night before. The last things he did were to be certain that his matches were dry and to wind his watch. The blankets were wet. His ankle pained him, but he knew only that he was hungry. Through his restless sleep, he dreamed of feasts and food served in all imaginable manners. When he awakened, he was cold and sick. There was no sun. The gray of the earth and sky had become deeper. A cold wind was blowing and snow was whitening the hilltops. The air about him grew white with snow as he made a fire and boiled more water. But it was wet snow, half rain. At first it melted as soon as it hit the earth, but it continued falling, covering the ground and destroying his fire. This was the signal for him to put his pack on his back and struggle forward. He knew not where. He was not concerned with the land of the little sticks, nor with Bill and the cache under the upturned boat by the River Dease. He was mad because of hunger. He did not notice the course he followed, except that it led him through the bottoms of the valleys. He felt his way through the wet snow to the watery muskeg berries, and was guided by touch as he pulled up the grass by the roots. But it had no taste, and did not satisfy his hunger. He had no fire that night, nor hot water. He pulled his blanket around him to sleep the broken sleep of hunger. The snow became a cold rain. He awakened many times to feel it falling on his upturned face. Day came. It was a gray day with no sun. It had ceased raining. The sharpness of his hunger had departed. There was a dull pain in his stomach, but it did not trouble him so much. He was more in control of himself, and once again he was interested in the land of little sticks and the cache by the River Dease. He cut the remains of one of his blankets into strips and bound his bleeding feet. He used one of the strips on his swelled ankle and prepared himself for a day of travel. When he was ready to pick up his pack, he paused long before deciding to keep the moose skin bag. But when he departed, it went with him. The snow had melted under the rain, and only the hilltops showed white. The sun appeared, and he succeeded in locating the way he had been traveling. But now he knew that he was lost. Perhaps he had wandered too far to the left. He now turned to the right to return to his true course. Although the hunger pains were not as great as they had been, he realized that he was weak. He was forced to pause for frequent rests. At those times, he ate the muskeg berries and grasses. His tongue felt dry and large, and it tasted bitter in his mouth. His heart troubled him very much. When he had traveled a few minutes, it would begin pounding. Then it would leap in a series of beats that made him feel faint. In the middle of the day, he found two small fish in a large pool. It was impossible to empty it. But he was calmer now, and he managed to catch them. They were no bigger than his little finger, but now he was not particularly hungry. The dull pain in his stomach had been growing duller. It almost seemed that his stomach was asleep. He ate the fish with great care. The eating was an act of pure reason. Although he had no desire to eat, he knew that he must eat to live. In the evening, he caught three more small fish, eating two and saving the third for breakfast. The sun had dried the wet plants, and he was able to build a fire. He had not traveled more than 10 miles that day. The next day, traveling whenever his heart permitted, he went no more than 5 miles. But his stomach did not give him any pain. It seemed to be sleeping. He was now in a strange country, too, and the caribou were becoming more plentiful. There were wolves also. Their howls could be heard across the land, and once he saw three of them crossing his path. Another night passed, and in the morning, being more reasonable, he untied the leather string that held the moose-skin bag. From its open mouth poured a yellow stream of gold dust. He divided the gold into two equal parts. One half, wrapped in a piece of a blanket, he hid among a large formation of rocks. The other half he returned to his bag. He also began to use strips of the one remaining blanket for his feet. He still kept his gun, because there were cartridges in that cache by the River Dease. This was a cloudy day, and this day hunger waked in him again. He was very weak. It was no uncommon thing now for him to fall. Once he fell into a bird's nest. There were four tiny birds, a day or so old, no more than a mouthful. He ate them greedily, putting them alive into his mouth and crushing them like eggshells between his teeth. The mother bird flew about him with cries of anger. He used his gun as a club with which to hit her, but she flew beyond his reach. He threw stones at her and by chance broke a wing. She then ran away, dragging the broken wing, with him following her. The little birds had not satisfied his hunger. He jumped along on his painful ankle, throwing stones and screaming loudly at times. At other times he struggled along silently, picking himself up patiently when he fell, or rubbing his eyes with his hand when faintness threatened to overpower him. The bird led him across some wet ground in the bottom of the valley. He discovered footprints in the wet grasses. They were not his own, he could see that. They must be Bill's. But he could not stop because the mother bird was running ahead. He would catch her first, then he would return and examine the footprints. He tired the mother bird, but he tired himself also. She lay on her side, breathing heavily. He lay on his side a dozen feet away, unable to move toward her. And as he recovered, she recovered. She flew beyond reach as his hungry hand stretched out to catch her. The hunt started again. Night darkened, and she escaped. He fell because of weakness, cutting his face. He did not move for a long time. Then he rolled on his side. He wound his watch and lay there until morning. It was another gray day. Half of his last blanket had been used for foot wrappings. He failed to find Bill's trail again. It was not important. His hunger drove him on. He wondered if Bill, too, were lost. By the middle of the day, the weight of his pack became too great. Again, he divided the gold, this time merely pouring half of it on the ground. In the afternoon, he threw away the rest of it. There remained now only the half of the blanket, the tin container, and the gun. A hallucination began to trouble him. He felt certain that one cartridge remained. It was in his gun, and he had not seen it. However, he knew all the time that the gun was empty. But the hallucination continued. He fought it for hours. Then he opened his gun eagerly, only to find nothing inside. He struggled ahead for half an hour when the hallucination arose again. Again he fought it, and still it continued. To give himself relief, he again opened the gun and found it empty. At times his mind wandered even further, but these moments away from reality were brief, because always the pains of hunger forced him to return. Once, as his mind was wandering, he was returned to reality by a sight that almost caused him to faint. Before him stood a horse. A horse! He could not believe his eyes. A thick cloud was in his eyes, flashing with points of light. He rubbed his eyes fiercely to clear his sight. Then he saw before him not a horse, but a great brown bear. The animal was studying him with curiosity.
That's all the time we have for today's show, but join us again tomorrow for another VOA Learning English program. Thanks for listening. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Friedman.